You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Goombangya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Zambeek. Welcome back to Talk the Walk. I'm so excited to have Pamela Trotman back on the show after our first conversation 3 years ago, dancing the reconciliation dance. In 2017, Pam was in the middle of writing her book, Triumphing Over Trauma, Journeys Beyond Woundedness. Now she's not only launched her book, but in fact started her own publishing company dedicated to works focusing on taking humanity forward towards peace and justice. Pamela's social work career began in Redfern over 50 years ago. She's worked in a range of settings from child protection to mental health, taking on many journeys of healing alongside trauma survivors from the stolen generations, refugees, and those experiencing family violence and child abuse. It is these experiences, as well as her own journey of recovery from child sexual abuse and multiple traumatic losses, that has inspired Pamela's new book. Pamela, congratulations on the new book. You must be really excited to have it out there after all this time.
Thank you very much, Lucy. Can I just actually say that I'm sitting here in my lovely Darwin home and I'm overlooking my garden, which is all on Larrakia land. So I want to acknowledge the Larrakia traditional owners because that's been important to me as I've gone through my journey as a non-Indigenous person. It's almost helped me to feel a lot more grounded in the sense that I can, once I'm recognising that Aboriginal people have been on this land for so long, it's almost as if I can connect with that knowledge and that wisdom and that sense of eternal being, I guess.
Oh, beautiful. I'm just picturing you sitting in your garden right now talking to me.
Yeah,
I do
yeah.
miss Darwin. What yes, struck me about your book, Pam, was the generosity of your own reflections and the sharing of your own personal journey. You don't hold back. You really opened your heart and you bared everything, scars and all. It's a beautiful book written by a wounded healer for other wounded healers, as well as the wounded. And I'm wondering, how difficult was it for you to write this book?
I didn't write the book. The book insisted that I write it. So when I left for over a decade beforehand, I'd actually decided I needed to write a book on trauma. But it took until, for that was from starting 2006, but it took until 2014 before I actually had the language to actually describe what had been befuddling me and grappling me and destabilising me for decades beforehand, and also recognising that in other trauma survivors as a counsellor, and that came into clarity back in August 2014 when I fractured my spine in the most bizarre situations, and which left me with a permanent impairment, a long-term permanent impairment, which was a cruel irony because I fractured the spine when I was actually in a guided program with a physiotherapy clinic to get myself fit and hearty for my old age because I realised I was 67 and I thought if I'm going to be active and fit in my old age I have to start work now on it. So that was a very cruel irony, but what it did was it gave me the notion of wounded, being wounded, because I'd got through so many other traumas in my life, psychological, but my body had always been there for me. And as much as I was overweight and unfit and all those sorts of things, I could always rely on my body. But the sense of being wounded really knocked me for six. And then I had another episode where I reactivated the injury 2 years later, which laid me low for 4 months. And my God, it was awful, absolutely dreadful. That was even worse in the few months following the injury. And so the notion of woundedness took shape.
Mm.
And as that took shape and I started to think about it, that's when I started to think to actually be able to put my finger on and my tongue around what were to, was to become seven different forms of what I have called traumatic wounding.
Right. So this own personal experience of injuring your spine really gave you a metaphor for actually introducing the idea of woundedness and injury in a psychological way with the work you were doing with people?
Yes, it did. I mean, I started working with trauma survivors, and in the book there's a, I speak about Janine, but in working with Janine, and it's a 34-year-old young woman who had survived 10 years of brutal sexual abuse by her father, she and her sister, in the 70s and in the early 80s. I was working with clients about the same time or even before they started to name post-traumatic stress disorder. And I wasn't working in the city. I was out in a regional city in New South Wales. So we didn't have the internet. So it took a long time before, you know, even the notion of post-traumatic stress disorder came to be well recognised. And of course, even then, in those days, it was still only related to war veterans. It was only in the decades after that that it started to be related to survivors, other survivors of trauma. And so the focus, of course, then was on, and I think it still is on with working with trauma survivors, is looking at how to help people manage the neurological reactions to extreme threat of the which triggers post-traumatic stress disorder and sustains post-traumatic stress disorder. But as much as I was listening and hearing and trying and using a variety of strategies to help people deal with those psychological disturbances and to help the brain refocus itself and move so it could integrate the memories of it without it being stuck in the trauma response part of the brain, which is the limbic system, but help it integrate it so that it becomes part of that, so the person can start to move on and get on with their lives. So my focus was always on trauma recovery rather than trauma treatment.
Before we get into, you know, the notions that you bring up in the book, I just wanted to go back to your experience of writing the book and what that process was like for you. Was the writing of this book actually a healing experience for yourself?
Not exactly, no, because I was able to write it because I'd actually, it was more an affirming thing because as I wrote, I realised that I had moved much further beyond the trauma than I had realised. Even when I was going back into my own situations or sitting describing situations with clients, I was doing that as if I was another eye, a third eye and another set of ears listening. It wasn't the me there. I had moved beyond it, if that makes sense. And I hadn't realised the extent to which I had actually transcended not just the individual trauma, but it transcended the whole, the impact of trauma on my life.
Can you speak a bit more about how you think your own personal experience has shaped your understandings of the impact of trauma?
I think one of the things that it's done is it made me recognise it's a kind of reality check, particularly in the Western world. I think we go through life and we're almost socialised to believe that we're protected in some way. But the reality is that life in itself has the potential for all kinds of threatening and life-threatening and emotionally threatening and destabilising experiences. And we're not necessarily taught how to deal with those. So as much as it happened to me, I actually found that in my efforts to understand and just to live as full a life as I could, that I actually started to learn what it was to be human. And that included having to find ways to overcome disasters.
Mm. Can you speak to an example of that, where you sort of had this insight, what it means to be human, through a personal experience that you had in your life?
Yes, I can. I mean, in the book, I talk about how my elder sister, Robin, was killed and was kicked in the head by a horse and 2 weeks before my 14th birthday, and how she took a week to die. And then that was when I was 14. And this time, on the 26th of June, 1970, which was 50 years ago yesterday, my father was killed in a plane crash, and we watched it. He was only 56. We found out about it. Well, I saw it on the, first of all, I saw it on the 6 o'clock news bulletin. He was only 56 and my mother was only 46 when we were killed. I'd just graduated literally from university, and my younger sister, Helen, was in the last year of her teaching studies and had just married. And because of that, my parents, who had put off studying, and their mother's dream was to go to Europe. They wanted to go on a ship to Europe. And she actually had bought leather, duck egg blue leather suitcases in a set of them to go and things. And anyway, it was a light plane crash. And my father had one of those duck egg blue suitcases, which he'd had. And it was one of the few things that survived. It got thrown out and it survived the crash and the ensuing fire. And so here I was at 23 and a half and my mother at 46, going 47. I realised, and so her dream and the vision of them going travelling that they'd put off for decades so that they could educate us, it was gone in an instant. That taught me that whole notion that we can't know when we're going to die. Most of us don't know when we're going to die unless we decide to do it ourselves, or we realise that we've got a life-threatening illness that's likely to take us out sooner rather than later. Mm. So that taught me at the grand age of 23, because at 23, I had a family of five, and we were only a small family with not a lot of extended family connections. In fact, none really. Suddenly it wasn't mum and dad and three daughters, it was mum and two daughters. And so that taught me that life was for living.
Right.
Life was for living, and that we can't postpone things in the belief that we will have better opportunities. So it didn't make me a hedonist, but it actually did shape the whole of my adulthood. And it continues to shape it in the sense that living is not just staying a job and paying off the mortgage and all those things. For me, living was being alive to the opportunities and challenges that life presents, so that I don't have to be frightened of the challenges. I don't have to be frightened of what might eventuate, but I can use my brain literally and knowledge and skills to explore the world and what it means to be a human being in this world.
Yeah, what strikes me about that idea that life is about living focuses your attention on hope for recovery, doesn't it? And that theme really comes across in your book, focusing on trauma recovery. Can you speak a bit about what we will read between the covers of your book that provide this different lens, this alternative perspective on the forces that impede recovery?
I need to do that. Yes, I will. And I think that's a good question. One of the things that I think we need to, in terms of the trauma therapeutic or the trauma mindset, both for therapists and I think too for clients or survivors, is that the focus on the impact of the traumatic experiences, the neurological, how that the brain is actually designed to survive with the fight, flight or freeze response, and which we can get stuck in, hence the post-traumatic stress disorders. But one of the things I think we've not given sufficient attention to, and it's happy, and neurologically or from in terms of neuroscience, the brain is also programmed to heal. Mm. So we've got two capacities in our brain, to survive but also to heal. Mm. And I think what's happening, what I've done in my life without realising it, but by taking that attitude that I had that life was for living, I actually triggered that healing capacity within my own brain. In researching and doing some research for this book, I've only just learned that there is now a lot of neurological evidence to say that we are programmed to heal. So I think that's the bit that we need to focus on. It stands to reason, because if our brains weren't programmed to heal, and we have a catastrophic event happen as a species, then we're not going to survive as a species very long. And so to me, that's the bit that I found really exciting in all my journey, is the wondrous capacity of what it is to be human. But it's also to recognize the dreadful rapacity of what humans can do to each other and what we can do to ourselves. So it's that looking at how does one use our brain to do that? If we're going to use all our brain, then we have to look also focus on how to recover.
Right. So what are the messages for readers in the book about what you call triumphing over trauma to help our clients reach that place of healing?
I mean, the book is raw. There's no doubt about that. Some of the stories are, they're very raw and they're not sanitized in any way, because to do so would be to minimize or dismiss the intensity of the experience and the suffering that it was involved at the time. But when people are reading a book, they will notice that it's written in the past tense, even not just my journey, but other people's journeys, like mm-hmm. Janine's, like Joanne's, that it's written in the past tense, in that those people, they've actually grappled with either with so I've grappled with myself and other people, because I've had counselling too. I'd go off and see one of the local counsellors. In grappling with it, that's the journey. It's a healing journey, and we have to have the capacity and the determination. And I think I talk in one of the chapters in the book about the client who actually wrote on the whiteboard that we need courage, determination and commitment, and that's what she expected of me, and that's what we need to do. But it's not just about courage, determination, commitment to deal with the trauma. It's about courage, determination, commitment to live life to the fullest, because we've only got one life.
Yes. And I was looking at your website earlier today and watching the little clip there about crossing the bridge and how that's a really important first step for people who have experienced trauma and wanting to find the courage, determination and commitment to take that first step in the healing journey. Can you speak a bit more about that metaphor of crossing the bridge?
One of the tragedies of trauma is that we can get stuck and stuck in this world, a murky world, and what I would call a quagmire or a swamp of a very difficult emotional and relationships and things as a result of the trauma. And once that continues, it becomes normal and people think, well, there's nothing else that's offered. But often there will be some sort of critical event, not another trauma, but a critical event that will stop the person in the tracks and make them think, oh, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
Just can't do this. And at that point, they've got a choice, and it is a deliberate, conscious choice. Do I accept and stick in this horrible, murky mess, or do I find the courage to reach out to someone to get help, because I can't do this on my own? I don't think there's much thing scarier in this world than actually putting your hand up as supposedly competent people and taking the time and effort to actually go and sit in a counsellor's chair. And it always reminded that, that for someone to be sitting there in front of me as a client has taken a huge amount of courage just to get there.
Yes.
And that's what I call about crossing the bridge, that we, in our safeness and security and comfort as counsellors, we can't sit there and say, oh, that's all right, let's come on in, We have to recognise that the getting there is absolutely arduous and can exhaust the people person. It can be a huge step, which is why I've drawn the picture of crossing on a rickety bridge, crossing a ravine, because it's a crossing a very sense of emptiness that we don't really not quite know what's going to happen, and we could fall into a pit and not know how to get out of it. And that's the bit about crossing the bridge to trauma recovery.
So in some ways, there's probably very little therapists can do to kind of help that person start to cross the bridge, because by the time we see them, they've already crossed it. For anyone listening that might be a family member of someone that they really care about who's experienced trauma, are there things they can do to kind of help them on the beginning point of that journey? Because I know that can be frustrating for family members watching on, can't it? They know they're in despair, but that feels like there's very little they can do.
It can, but one of the things that, and yes, the families need to be patient, but they need to have compassion. and to be able to respect the fact that even for children, that the time to take that journey is that it must be the individual decision. It can't be anybody else's mandated or prompted decision because they think it's the best thing for them. But getting back to your comment about how counsellors, we can't do anything, we can do a lot. We can do a lot, particularly for intake workers, where we're not just getting information or having our first, often telephone contact with the client when they ring up, where we listen and we don't just get the basic information of what the issues are, but we actually provide some sort of hand that reaches out to them across what is for them potentially an abyss.
Yeah, beautiful.
Often I'm saying to clients, because I'm working in private practice and get referrals, I'm actually saying, what about if you just come and have a yarn to me and we'll see whether we can work together?
Yes. See whether they can take that next step across the ravine, hey?
Whether they can, having got there, whether or not I'm the right person, because if I'm not, then it becomes my obligation to help them once they're on the other side to find someone who may be able to help them. So then if it doesn't work for me, they're not stuck in no man's land on the other side.
That's so important, that the first contact that people have when they do reach out, isn't it?
And to do that, I've done two more videos and I've got to put them up on the YouTube. And one of them is actually describing what the healing relationship is about. So it's a little graphic and a little talking about what constitutes the healing relationship and how to sustain it and how we can only heal through relationship. And that's both with others and with ourselves. We have to find that good harmony in ourselves and with others. The sense of connection is the biggest, the disturbance to the sense of connection and wholeness to self and others is what is the most destabilizing and destructive element of a trauma. So we have to find ways to reconnect healthily with other people and with ourselves. So I've done that little video. And the next one is sustaining the healing journey. So moving along from that picture that I first done and saying, looking at once you get moving, what's likely to happen and how do you sustain the healing journey?
Great. I look forward to writing in the show notes how people can access those resources. I just wanted to go back to the book. And one of the things that really got me thinking as I was reading it is about this idea of the secondary trauma and its flow-on effect for survivors. For example, you speak about the trauma that's experienced by direct child abuse, but also the traumatic wounding that occurs by institutions that deny that original trauma occurring and try to cover it up. Is that what makes this book different? Because you actually name what those wounds are, the ones that we haven't really been talking about?
Yes, I think it is. I think in my research, of the seven forms of traumatic wounding, which is no order of importance, but injustice, denial, rejection, moral injury, loss and grief, shame and guilt and betrayal. Of those seven, five of them, there's actually been formal research that validates that people who've experienced those that actually have worse or poorer mental health outcomes post-trauma than those people who don't experience that level of woundedness. I'm probably one of the few people that's actually put them together and named them. For example, there's a lot of people doing research on the impact of shame and guilt about racism, of how racism impacts on people of colour and how that impedes their mental health outcomes and physical health outcomes. And that happens in the States and in Australia. There's research in that, which I talk about in the book, in terms of shame and guilt. Same for injustice and loss and grief. But it's the naming of them that does it, because again, neurologically speaking, I've read an article many years ago now that when people who are feeling distressed but can't name the distress or put a word to the distress, there was a research done where people were given what they call a functional MRI, where they can actually see the firing of the neurons in the moment, not just a picture of the brain, but the actual functioning of the brain. Mm-hmm. And this research showed that when people were in a heightened state of distress but couldn't name the distress or what was distressing them, the neurons were firing, if I remember correctly, in all directions. Mm-hmm. However, because that's the right-hand side of the brain, the emotional side of the brain. Once they're able to activate the left-hand side of the brain, which is the rational, the languaging side, and to find a word to describe what they were feeling, their brain settled down. And so in that sense, we need to use both sides of our brain. I think that's what trauma treatment is only been focusing too much on the reactive side of the brain, of the distress side, rather than helping the brain to get its head around what's happened to it.
Right. So in the case of the child abuse example I shared before, we've had too much focus on the actual incident itself and not so much focus on the things that happened after that continue to cause distress and hurt for this person because of the denial of institutions and things like that.
That's right. And that's why I write about it and why I write about my own family's denial of my sexual abuse. The actual abuse is part of it. But the really wounding part that for myself, was more about how my family didn't acknowledge what this meant to me, and that dismissive of me, because when that denial, not only denials the story and the event, but the denial actually negates the person. Because if in order to actually dismiss the events and their significance, one has to negate the person who's telling the story, you know, or dismiss it in some ways, whether it's by saying, oh, they're just children fabricating or whatever. And that's where the real wounding comes about. I think that of denial, that's where the real wounding comes about. It's the link to the event, but the power of the dismissal or the denial or the rejection of the person is that's what becomes the lasting wound. And if you listen to the reports of people at the recent Royal Commission, that's what was the pain that they experienced, that they hadn't, nobody had given credence to this is what they were talking about and acted.
I wondered whether we could focus the second half of our conversation around your work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, because most of our audience listening today, that's an interest of theirs. What do you think your work with the Stolen Generations in particular has taught you? How has that influenced your understanding of the impacts of trauma and how recovery happens?
That's a very big one. I think one of the things that I have to go back is to why we, you know, what's the trauma, the naming of the nature of the trauma. Mm. And so it's not just what's happening now for people, it's what triggered, what caused the trauma in the first place. And of course, with the Stolen Generation, it was that policy that Aboriginal mothers were not capable of, that whiteness was better than Aboriginality. And so any child born of an Aboriginal mother from a white father, then they had to, you know, they got removed on that basis because Aboriginal people were not valued. Because remembering in those times, Aboriginal people weren't even citizens. The mentality of colonisation is that these were savages, Aboriginal people that had no, so there was no recognition that these people were human beings. Mm. Absolutely no recognition that these people, different colour, different customs, with different ways of speaking, different dress, but they were another human being. And it was that denial of that humanity which actually was the basis of the Stolen Generation. And, of course, it continues to be the pain because it continues to be denied. You're not good enough to be full members of this Australian society. It was only 1967 when we actually made Aboriginal people legally citizens of Australia. So any Aboriginal person my age in those days, so born at the same age as me, they weren't required to register their birth, deaths or marriages. So, and of course, because of that, until 1967, they weren't entitled to any housing. So, and they weren't entitled to all the benefits and all the so-called privileges of a prosperous white community. And it literally put out to the back. So there's an expression called blacks out the back. So for a non-Indigenous person, a white person, working with Aboriginal people, the challenge is not about how to fix Aboriginal people. There's a wonderful book out written by Mark Moran called Serious White Fella Business When Solutions Become the Problem in Indigenous Affairs. And he's talking about, he's actually got narratives around half a dozen different Aboriginal communities and they struggle, the struggles they have around white policies and practice and government interventions and things. And so, and that's the bit that I think that we as non-Indigenous and particularly white social workers, we have to challenge ourselves constantly. To what extent does our socialisations, one of white privilege, actually shape the way we think and behave towards Aboriginal people?
Yeah, and I'm wondering about how does our white privilege contribute to the continuation of traumatic wounding in particular?
Well, I think it does. That's why in the book I've actually talked about that, about how the policies are affecting people today. The policies, those policies and that thinking are still impacting on people today. It's social workers, we part, we earn our money, we get quite good salaries from these sorts of things. And unless we recognise and ways to do that, we can become unwitting conduits to the imposition of that negating, rejecting, dismissive thinking that makes Aboriginal people less human.
I was just brought to mind by an experience in my own community, actually. I live in Barrowville, where there's three families who've been fighting for justice for the murder of their kids for over 30 years. And it strikes me there are multiple traumatic wounds for these families and the whole of the community. And despite years of trying to get their day in court and have someone accountable for the loss of their kids, they still have no justice. How important do you think it is that a sense of justice happens for the process of healing? How might there be healing for those families, given that the traumatic wounding is still occurring?
Look, I know that Barrowville story, and it's most tragic, and it's a notion of what constitutes justice. And I was forced to recognise this, and I grappled with this when, after 50-odd years, when I actually decided I'd lodge a claim, compensation for my sexual abuse. I was turning 60. The abuse stopped when I was 7, so that was a long time previously. And I did the work of it. And the reason I did it was that because as much as I had overcome the trauma and done a whole lot of work healing from the actual sexual abuse, and my sister and I, Robin and I, had actually disclosed the abuse when we moved to another town. And we got tested and did all of those sorts of things. But we even had physical examination and the doctor declared that because we were Virgo intacta, the man hadn't attempted to try to penetrate us. People know this these days, that there's very often little evidence, physical medical evidence, to talk about penetration unless it's immediately afterwards where there's DNA or semen or something like that. When it's actually historical, then it's hard to do. For me, and I was working in child protection at the time, the thing that was gnawing at me and prompted me to do it was that this man, despite our childhood efforts to tell our story, nothing happened. And I'm thinking, this man has probably gone on and abused a lot of other children. And I actually found out where he lived. And he was still alive and living not very far. When we made our disclosures, they said, oh, but they didn't know how to find him. And yet he'd been living in a town probably only less than 100 kilometres from where the abuse took place, probably all that time. So for me, it was the pursuit of the claim for compensation. I needed to do it to try and find some way, because I didn't want to go into my old age with that sense of justice had not been served. And I had needed to do everything in my power to actually find ways, to bring him to Brooke. So that meant that I did the research and tried to find out, get the evidence and all those sorts of things. But that didn't come to anything. But it did provide the material for me to have that abuse formally recognised. Right. And remembering that my family, my only two remaining family members, were actually dismissing it all to me, in some ways. So when I got the letter the letter with the check, almost four-fifths, it was four-fifths of the full amount that could be paid, that said, in the light of the evidence, the information provided, that tribunal has come to the decision that this abuse took place.
So even though he was not accountable for the actual event, what constituted justice for you was actually this claim of compensation, which was successful, acknowledging that it was more than likely that it occurred.
Yes, and I talk about that, the same story with Joanne in the book, about how her pursuit helped her to get a sense of justice from her things. And it's the justice of being heard. So I wonder whether or not the people in Bowerville, whether or not they could be, well, I don't even, they've even thought about it, but whether it would be useful for them to lodge a claim for compensation for loss and grief and for the murders, because it's clearly, it's recognised as murder. So a crime has been committed, but there hasn't been a perpetrator. They haven't found a perpetrator. So I would encourage those people in Bowerville to find some way that they can have a sense of justice, not legal justice, because often legally we can't get justice. It's another sense of justice. And that was, for me, the justice was I had form, and for Joanne, our travail and our suffering had been formally recognised.
Right, yes. The justice of being heard, it counts for a lot, doesn't it?
It's a huge amount. And not just heard, oh, there, that's sorry, oh, that's really sad, I'm sorry that's happened. Being formally heard, legally heard. And that's what I think was a lot of the healing process for a lot of people for the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Sexual Abuse. People got the chance to be formally heard, and their testimony was recognised as valid.
Well, that gives me a great sense of hope, actually, that there can be a sense of justice for our community. Thank you for sharing those thoughts.
I mean, how you do it and as individuals and how you do it as a community is something, but I think it maybe it's a question of how, if the legal justice is unlikely to be coming, how long do you want to carry this wound for? Because it's still an open wound. How long do you want to carry it for?
You mentioned Joanna before, and I wondered whether that's a particular client story you'd like to share. This is a young Aboriginal woman you worked with for many years. Can you speak a bit about Joanna's journey of triumphing over trauma and how it was made possible?
Yeah, so Joanne is when I met her, which was in October 2000, and she had just given birth to her fourth child. This was when I was working with Danila Dilber Aboriginal Health Service, which was the Emotional Social Wellbeing Centre. So Joanne, she was just 23 and a half. She'd just given birth to her fourth child. She was trying to escape a domestic violence situation with her second partner. And she had Ross River fever, and she was being expected to support her sister cousin, who had a severe mental health condition, and who also had her own baby, newborn baby. And the mental health services were expecting Joanne to support her cousin sister while in the middle of all of this. So Joanne comes to me. She spoke in whispers. I could barely hear her. Anyway, we worked together for a long time, just dealing with, first of all, helping her to deal with the rigours of being a young mother of four children, all under seven, and other family issues around where she was not getting a lot of family support, but also just to help her find a way out of the relationship, the violent relationship. So for a long time, and we worked together effectively for close on two decades, and in the process of that, she followed me around from different agencies that I work with, and sometimes I couldn't give her direct support, but other times I would mentor her on the phone. And she had disclosed when previously about being sexually abused by relatives when I was at Danila Dilber, and they were in almost inaudible whispers, which made it harder because she had long hair and she'd put her head down and her hair would fall down like a veil across her face. It was very difficult, but in the time when I was working at relationships, she slowly found the voice, literally found the voice to talk about being sexually abused as a child, and found the voice to tell her birth mother and her other mother, Aboriginal other mother, who was her maternal aunt, to tell them what had happened. Now, they weren't particularly supportive, but then she set out on her own decision to make a claim for compensation. And so we went through all of that. And each step she got to made the claim, and it was knocked back, not enough evidence, which, of course, there wasn't going to be because this is historical. But she decided she was going to appeal, and a little voice inside of me thought, oh, God. And I thought, it's not my choice. And this is the important thing I think we have to remember. Mm. As much as we doubt the person's capacity, we have to respect and honour their life decisions, you know, even if it goes against what we think is our wisdom. So anyway, so Joanne lodged an appeal, and it went around, and we had to go and look for more and more evidence and to substantiate what had happened. And every bit was a dead end. And in this time, in this process, she'd had one another stillborn child. By the time it came to the tribunal and where she actually went to speak to the tribunal about her appeal, she actually had another child at her breast, and she was literally suckling it, of course. So we were sitting there in this long, round, oblong table with the registrar at one end, and by then it was the big male, middle-aged male man from the Department of Justice who was listening and trying to establish the valid. And Joanne's sitting opposite him, and she's literally suckling the child just to keep it quiet because there was no one else to look after. And I'm sitting a metre or so to her right because I'm wanting to, this is her journey and I can't speak for her. And I was determined not to unless I was invited or given permission to speak. Mm. And in that process, and I'll remember this to the day I die, it was the most beautiful process. They kept giving her permission to go and find extra evidence. So this was about an 18-month process. It wasn't just one session. So they really did everything they could to give her the opportunity to get the evidence. So this was the very last session. And this man, and he was a beautiful man, but his knowledge of child sexual abuse, I have to say, was not very good, because he asked the question of why didn't you tell somebody about it? Oh. I mean, and that's not to condemn him. That just shows that's what happens. You know, we don't know about these things. Anyway, that's how he started in this process. But as we sat there this day in 2012, and you can picture this, Joanne's big-breasted, beautiful young woman, absolutely gorgeous young woman, really very good-looking young woman. And she's suckling this baby, and he's sitting opposite her. And he sums up, he says, well, I've decided that it's probably because I'm nearing retirement, but decided I'm going to listen to you, and I've decided that you've given me enough and you've answered enough of my questions. I'm going to decide that, yes, we'll grant this compensation. And I'll also grant payment of all the fees that you've given to all the things like the psychologist reports and those for them to be paid, so you don't have to pay them out of your compensation. Anyway, Joanne couldn't take it in to begin. We get outside, she said, well, what did he say, Pam? And I told her, you know, and that was so powerful. What she had done when she had found her voice, and she had made, and she not only found her voice, but she had got someone in authority to listen and to heed what she was saying and to validate it as having credence and having some valid, you know, that it was a real event. It wasn't just in her imagination.
What strikes me is the image of sitting in front of that judge, the kind of stance she would have in her body, and how in contrast that would be with the image that comes to my mind when you first met her with her hair hanging in front of her face, full of shame. There's such a contrast there, and what a journey it must have been to go from that place to being acknowledged and be heard.
There's something even more moving. Some time later, it would have been a year or so, maybe a couple of years later, and I think it was when I was writing her story in the book, and I was wanting to make sure that it was okay and she was not going to be publicly shamed about it. And she said, Pam, I have no shame. I don't need to be shamed about any of that. That's what was done to me. I don't need to take on that shame anymore. I'm free of that shame.
And it was only in the naming of that shame initially, I imagine, that she was able to get to that place.
Yeah, she used to be so ashamed. But the other thing that's really, Joanne has now, she's got 8 children now, and there has been minimal child protection involvement, minimal juvenile justice involvement, despite, you know, and things. So it's against all the other indicators of what happens with Aboriginal families and things. She's actually found the energy and the strength and the knowledge and wisdom within to find her, to deal with her own issues.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story, Pam. And there are so many wonderful stories in your book, including your own and how you overcome your own traumas. I really recommend it as a read for wounded therapists, unwounded therapists like myself. There's so much to learn. And the wounded themselves who are wanting to take this first step to cross that bridge. Congratulations on the book. And thanks so much for talking with me about it today.
Thank you. Can I add a postscript?
Of course.
That on my website for the book, there's that video, the video that you talked about, and I sent a copy of that to Joanne for her to have a look. And in the video, I say that as a counsellor, I can't fix you, that survivor. And Joanne emails me back, "You're wrong. You fixed me. I wouldn't be the person I am without you."
That stands for a lot, to say that the therapist's role is actually an important one too.
Yes, it is. If I may, I want to finish at this, that the therapist's role is a role of great nobility and great honour, that when we walk beside people and help them in their healing journey, we don't get depleted, we get enriched in our lives. But it's a very, very enriching and life-affirming and humanity-affirming process. So I would encourage therapists to actually not to be frightened of it, to be prepared to connect with the human that wants to be bigger than the trauma.
Beautiful. Thanks for finishing on those really poignant words. If people would like to purchase the book or at least find out more information about it, where should they go, Pam?
The website is www.noah, as in Noah's Ark, noahpublishing.com.au. And if they want to just email me, they can buy it from me directly.
And I'll put the website address, your email address, up on the show notes as well if people get a bit lost.
But the other thing is, if there are survivors out there that would like to talk with me, I'm actually offering to help people locate local services and support services and counselling services. So if they've got any issues, they can contact me on email and I'm happy to support them.
Thank you so much, Pam, for chatting with us.
I really appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.